Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Today, I'm reading from the June 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. We just got this issue in. So I'll begin with this article, The Shape of Freedom. In 1869, three formerly enslaved artisans started a stoneware business in Central Texas. A century and a half later, they put their stamp on the art world. By Jacoba Erst. In 1856, the Reverend John McCamey Wilson, Jr., a Presbyterian minister and entrepreneur interested in clay science, relocated from North Carolina to Texas. There in the Capote Hills, a rural, sparse enclave in Guadalupe County, 12 miles from the town of Seguin, Wilson opened up a business called Guadalupe Pottery. Wilson mainly sold jugs, churns, crocks, and cemetery flower jars. The pots featured crescent handles and a deep chocolate-colored interior of liquefied clay. Before refrigerators and ice boxes, high-fire, non-porous pottery was essential to life, the Tupperware or Ziploc bags of the 19th century. Clay pots preserved everything from grains, beef, and butter to whiskey and even drinking water. The potters who worked under Wilson's direction mostly used alkaline glaze, one of the oldest methods in ceramics, to create a glassy exterior from a slurry of wood ash, sand, and clay. An arduous process in the 1850s, it took days to stoke underground wood-burning kilns to a high enough temperature for a successful firing. Three of Wilson's potters were enslaved servants who traveled to Texas with him, Hiram, James, and Wallace. For more than a decade, these men were responsible for nearly every facet of Guadalupe Pottery's production, from mixing clay and expertly throwing the pots on a kick wheel to glazing and stacking vessels and meticulously controlling the temperature and duration of the kiln's flames. The men kept working for the Reverend even after Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. In Texas, slavery didn't end until June 19, 1865, when Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston and issued General Order No. 3, informing the people of Texas that all who'd been enslaved were free. The event commemorated as Juneteenth. In 1869, Hiram founded his own stoneware business at a new site with James and Wallace, H. Wilson and Company. Though not biologically related, all three took their enslaver's surname, the practice of some black Americans at the time. Some scholars believe that H. Wilson and Company was the first business in Texas founded and owned by formerly enslaved people. A century and a half later, the pots they made are celebrated in the ceramics world, in silvery grays and greens with uneven salt drips and textured glazes that resemble the moon's surface, or sometimes an orange peel. Wilson wares are coveted both as objects d'art and for their extraordinary story of black determination in the post-war South. Wilson pottery now resides in museums across the United States, from the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston, an indelible part of the country's entrepreneurial and creative heritage. The story of Hiram, James, and Wallace Wilson is woven through the threads of folklore, given the sparse records kept at the time, particularly for people born into slavery. But over the past 50 years, researchers have uncovered more details about the Wilsons. Georgiana Greer, a San Antonio pediatrician and ceramics collector aficionado, was passionate about locating abandoned kilns, and she left a trove of Wilson information behind, including a 1973 taped interview with James Wilson's son, James Wilson Jr. Emancipation offered the Wilsons an opportunity none had ever expected. Establishing a pottery business was complex and costly. It meant finding a suitable site, testing clay, constructing a kiln, and hiring proficient workers. And the men did all this in an intensely dangerous environment, said Ashley Williams, a recent fellow at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. In the late 1860s, black residents of Guadalupe County filed almost 200 complaints with the Freedmen's Bureau for unpaid wages and violent crimes perpetrated against them. A Baptist missionary from Maine, the Reverend Leonard Isley, helped Hiram buy 600 acres of land for $500, and likely either gave Hiram a personal loan or served as a guarantor in the transaction. When Hiram died in 1884, survived by his wife, Cynthia, and 11 children, Isley served as administrator of his estate. One of Hiram's great-great-granddaughters, Laverne Lewis Britt, first discovered her connection to the Potters after her retirement, when she became interested in genealogy. Over the course of 5 years, she researched and wrote a book called In Praise of Hiram Wilson, which describes how her ancestor created a thriving post-slavery community in Capote. Hiram set aside 10 of his 600 acres for a Baptist church and became its minister. The White Steeple Chapel remains active today beside a cemetery with cedar and crepe myrtle trees. Many Wilsons have been laid to rest there, including Hiram, whose grave is marked by a tall obelisk. Hiram also founded a one-room schoolhouse where Paula King Harper, another of his descendants, says her grandmother once taught. King Harper is the current president of the Wilson Pottery Foundation. On the phone, she described how interest in her celebrated ancestors' technique had spread in collector circles since the organization's founding in 1999. A pottery collector in San Antonio was at a garage sale and noticed the green salt glaze drip from underneath dirt that had dried on a gallon jug. They purchased it for less than $10, went home, cleaned it up, and guess what it was? A stamped H. Wilson. Finding that stamp is now the equivalent of finding a signed painting by a renowned artist. King Harper once set at an auction that included several pieces of Wilson pottery from someone's private estate. There was a beautiful, pristine 5-gallon jug I watched sell for $12,000, she said. Traditionally, clay artists who made Quetodian jugs and jars rather than purely aesthetic works have been considered second-tier makers, ranking below sculptors. But over the last few decades, contemporary and historic ceramicists, like the Wilsons, are receiving new scholarly and art world attention. Williams, the recent Smithsonian Fellow, is researching the Wilsons as part of her doctorate at Columbia University. She notes that most enslaved potters wouldn't have been able to inscribe their names or initials on a pot. But once the Wilson potters were free, they added a maker's mark, which made all the difference. future generations were able to dive into the records and find out more about the remarkable potters. Because we can tie the makers to these objects, which is so rare, it allows us to see the story about the resilience of the Wilson potters during slavery and their extreme success and survival, Williams said. The Wilson style may have been influenced by the works coming out of the Edgefield district in South Carolina, a place then known as a kind of pottery mecca. It was famous for massive, bulbous jars and glazes, features that the early Wilson pots share. Edgefield has its own significant history of highly skilled black craftsmen, including David Drake, the earliest known enslaved potter to inscribe his work. Later, the Wilson's pottery took on more distinctive features. The men started out using alkaline glaze, but once they opened their own business, they switched to salt glaze, likely for its strength and waterproofing properties. Salt glaze also produces more consistent colors and textures, such as the bumpy orange peel finish admired by H. Wilson and Company collectors. At the time, the method was uncommon in Texas, according to Michelle Johnson, project manager of the William J. Hill Texas Artisans and Artists Archive at the Bayou Bend Collection and Gardens, part of the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston. And it was dangerous, she said, because salt glaze produces highly toxic chlorine gas from the wet salt thrown into the kiln during firing. For this reason, contemporary ceramicists avoid the method altogether. The Wilsons may have learned the technique from Isaac Suttles, an Ohio-born potter known for salt glazing, who is listed in the United States Census as living in Seguin at the time. Lid rims are another notable element of H. Wilson and Company's jars. At the first pottery-making site, during their enslavement, the men made more tie-down rims, jars without lids that require paper or cloth as a cover, which were easier and faster to make. Later, at their own shop, they crafted rims fitted for lids. These lid rims allowed for more watertight storage, but they also required more sophisticated expertise. If you think you may have stumbled on one of those treasures at a garage or estate sale, look for a horseshoe-like handle, the most significant visual identifier of a Wilson pot. It's still unclear why Hiram, James, and Wallace switched to these thicker, rolled handles from their original Edgefield-inspired crescents. It may have been because horseshoe handles are sturdier, offering more surface connection to the pot's body. It's another puzzling question that Williams is pursuing and hopes to answer in the future. It took a long time for the art world to discover the Wilson's creations. After Hiram's death in 1884, James and Wallace Wilson went on to work at another pottery site run by Marion Durham, a potter from South Carolina who had moved to Texas with John Chandler, who was most likely his enslaved servant at the time. By the time the Wilsons joined them, Durham and Chandler were in business together. That site closed in 1903. These pots remained in circulation, but many details of their story were lost. Decades later, an anthropology graduate student named Elmer Joe Brackner Jr. conducted a magnetometry survey to find buried pottery. Clay contains iron oxides that can become magnetized. At the original Guadalupe pottery site, he found what's known as a groundhog kiln, a uniquely southern, semi-subterranean kiln used in the 19th century for firing alkaline glazed pottery. At the second site, home of the independent H. Wilson and Company, Brackner found ceramic glazed shards and another groundhog kiln. His research and that of Georgiana Greer, the ceramic historian, helped piece together the Wilson's unusual story. After many years of advocacy by the Wilson Pottery Foundation, art historians and curators began scouring land deeds, court documents, and handwritten capacity marks, numbers that denote the volume of each jug. To present a fuller picture of the Wilsons, sometimes correcting previous theories about their methodology and timeline. Texas ceramic artist Earlene Green researches the Wilsons' past while creating her own pottery to honor their legacy. In 2018, she interviewed Wilson descendants and collectors and visited historical societies in Texas for archival information. 2 years later, she curated an exhibition on her campus in Fort Worth. The show also displayed ceramic pieces she had created based on the work of the Wilson Potters. The narrative continues to evolve, due in no small part to proud descendants of Hiram, James, and Wallace. Every 3 years, hundreds of people gather in Seguin, Texas, for a jubilant 3-day Wilson family reunion that is open to the public. In 2023, festivities included the Wilson Pottery Foundation Gala and a 10th anniversary celebration at the Wilson Pottery Museum. The last reunion fell on the weekend before Juneteenth, and the reunion committee arranged a kickoff concert Sunday evening, followed by Juneteenth events in Seguin's downtown square. I was fortunate to grow up in Texas in the 1980s, around the time when our cousin, Laverne Lewis Britt, had uncovered the history, explains Dison McClinton Holland, the photographer of this story, and a Wilson descendant through his maternal grandmother. I grew up knowing bits of the story and visiting the church. He describes the process of documenting Hiram Wilson's legacy as a healing journey. To think he was born into slavery and was able to accomplish so much shortly thereafter, he says. It's inspiring and motivating to think of all the freedoms we have now, and that we really have to push a bit harder. That completes the article. The author, Jacoba Urist, is an arts and culture writer and has been contributing to the Smithsonian Magazine since 2016. The article's title was The Shape of Freedom. The next article is titled A Measure of Change. Scientist Charles Keeling's ingenious flask detects swings in the Earth's atmosphere, by Ashley Braun. To unlock the secrets of the atmosphere, first travel away from cities, forests, cars, and people to somewhere the air blows clean. Say the top of a Hawaiian volcano. Bring 2 round glass flasks, volleyball-sized, but with the air vacuumed out, wrapped in surgical tape for safety. Point the glass nozzle jutting from each toward that fresh air. Now hold your breath and walk at least 10 feet into the wind. Open the valve, let the air rush in, and well after the hissing has stopped, close it back up. Then you can breathe once you've done all that, says Tim Luker, a scientist with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Now you have an air sample, and I'm still amazed that it works. Charles David Keeling established this method in the mid-1950s at the California Institute of Technology. Back then, scientists didn't know how much carbon dioxide naturally occurred in the atmosphere. Measurements varied widely. Keeling cracked how to measure it precisely. Then he took this endeavor to new heights, 11,000 feet above sea level. At a 1956 meeting with a research director at the U.S. Weather Bureau, a precursor to the National Weather Service, Keeling made an ambitious pitch, continuously monitoring CO2 using a gas analyzer, a high-tech but as yet unproven tool for the job. The Bureau's new research station on Hawaii's Mauna Loa volcano, with its high altitude and barren landscape, would prove to be the ideal collection spot. Along with that continuous monitoring, scientists would also gather 5-liter air flask snapshots, sampled in pairs at remote locations around the world, analyzing the results under controlled laboratory conditions. Nearly on the spot, Keeling was offered funding to build a CO2 program, taking it to Scripps in La Jolla, California. He began measurements in 1958. As months and years of data arrived, Keeling's rigorous work revealed two global phenomena. Earth's plants inhaling CO2 each summer and exhaling it each winter, and CO2's levels unrelenting annual increase. The undulating graph marking the atmospheric CO2 concentration would become known as the Keeling curve. On January 29, 1982, at the Mauna Loa Observatory, a NOAA employee first filled glass flask I-457 when atmospheric CO2 levels measured 341.28 parts per million. Analyzed at the Scripps lab, this sample also could now reveal CO2's fingerprints from sources like living things, fossil fuels, and volcanoes. In the early 1980s, Luker joined Keeling's lab in La Jolla. The researchers were grappling with major questions of global carbon math, from the ocean to the sky. Activities like burning fossil fuels and making cement release CO2, but only half of the carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere. Land-based plants and the ocean, to a limit, absorb the rest. Determining those fractions and limits, the mathematical destination of fossil fuel CO2, was a contentious scientific question, complicated by the burning of the Amazon rainforest to clear land for farming. Essential to much of this work was understanding how and where the planet cycles one of its most widely distributed elements through the atmosphere, ocean, and land. Those answers hissed out of glass flasks like I-457, gathered at stations from near the North Pole to Mauna Loa, and from the tiny Christmas Island to the South Pole. In his later years, Charles Keeling reflected on the slow-footed public response to growing evidence of climate change. People, he wrote in 1998, should heed the rise in atmospheric CO2 concentration as serious unless proven to be benign. He died in 2005. On June 7, 2022, Flask I-457 took its own last breath on Mauna Loa before embarking on a different journey, one to the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Curator Kristen Frederick Frost remembers the flask arriving at the museum, perfectly cradled in its custom padding. She marveled at the box's design, made to ship fragile flasks all over the world. One of my big regrets is not collecting the box. We had to send it back, she says. When the flask took in its last sample in 2022, atmospheric CO2 levels registered 421.36 ppm, a concentration that Luker calls unbelievable. When the instrument first began collecting samples in 1982, CO2 levels had been 80 ppm lower. At that point, the fires, the droughts, the floods, the powerful hurricanes, that was all hypothetical, he says. And now we're living through it. With global CO2 continuing to rise faster than expected, the Scripps team is part of a monitoring effort, trying to understand why. The Los Angeles Megacity Carbon Project, a collaboration between Scripps and other organizations, seeks to zero in on the localized sources and forms of pollution in Southern California cities to better address it. Flask samples still deduce sources' CO2 fingerprints. It's almost like a crystal ball, the glass flask, Luker adds. It's just stunning that such a simple invention could have such a profound effect. That completes the article, A Measure of Change, by Ashley Braun. And that also completes the broadcast today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I've been reading from the June 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the tremendous programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.